Where, finally for this hour, the godmother of punk music, Patti Smith, continues to read from her memoir of life in New York in the late 1960s and 70s, Just Kids. And we join Patti and her friend, the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, on a day trip south of Manhattan by the sea.
I always loved the ride to Coney Island. Just the idea that you could go to the ocean via subway was so magical. I was absorbed in a biography of Crazy Horse when I suddenly returned to the present and looked at Robert. He was like a character in Brighton Rock, in his 40s-style hat, black net t-shirt and huaraches. We pulled into our stop. I leapt to my feet, filled with the anticipation of a child, slipping the book back into his sack. He took my hand. Nothing was more wonderful to me than Coney Island with its gritty innocence. It was our kind of place. The fading arcades, the peeling signs of bygone days, cotton candy and Cupid dolls on a stick, dressed in feathers and glittering top hats. We wandered through the last gasp of the sideshows. They had lost their luster, though they still touted such human oddities as the donkey-faced boy, the alligator man, and the three-legged girl. Robert found the world of freaks fascinating, though of late he was foregoing them for leather boys in his work. We strolled the boardwalk and got our picture taken by an old man with a box camera. We had to wait for an hour for it to be developed, so we went to the end of the long fishing pier where there was a shack that served coffee and hot chocolate. Pictures of Jesus, President Kennedy, and the astronauts were taped to the wall behind the register. It was one of my favorite places, and I would often daydream of getting a job there and living in one of the old tenement buildings across from Nathan's. All along the pier, young boys and their grandfathers were crabbing. They'd slide raw chicken as bait in a small cage on a rope and hurl it over the side. The pier was swept away in a big storm in the 80s, but Nathan's, which was Robert's favorite place, remains. Normally, we only had money for one dog and a Coke. He would eat most of the dog, and I most of the sauerkraut. But that day, we had enough money for two of everything. We walked across the beach to say hello to the ocean, and I sang him the song Coney Island Baby by the Excellents. We wrote our names in the sand. We were just ourselves that day, without a care. It was our good fortune that this moment in time was frozen in a box camera. It was our first real New York City portrait, who we were. Only weeks before, we had been at the bottom, but our blue star, as Robert called it, was rising. We boarded the F train for the long ride back, returned to our little room and cleared off the bed, happy to be together. It snowed on Christmas night. We walked to Times Square to see the white billboard proclaiming, "War is over, if you want it. Happy Christmas from John and Yoko." It hung above the bookstall where Robert bought most of his men's magazines, between Child's and Benedict's, two all-night diners. Looking up, we were struck by the ingenuous humanity of this New York City tableau. Robert took my hand, and as the snow swirled around us, I glanced at his face. He narrowed his eyes and nodded in affirmation, impressed to see artists take on 42nd Street. For me, it was the message. For Robert, the medium. The 60s were coming to an end. Robert and I celebrated our birthdays. Robert turned 23, then I turned 23, the perfect prime number. Robert made me a tie rack with the image of the Virgin Mary. I gave him 7 silver skulls on a length of leather. He wore the skulls. I wore a tie. We felt ready for the 70s. "It's our decade," he said. I was sitting in the lobby trying to appear that I wasn't waiting for Robert. Unable to concentrate, I sat in my usual spot, bent over my orange composition book containing my cycle of poems for Brian Jones. I was dressed in my Song of the South get-up, straw hat, Brer Rabbit jacket, work boots and peg pants, and was hammering away at the same set of phrases when I was interrupted by an oddly familiar voice. "What you doing, darling?" I looked up into the face of a stranger sporting the perfect pair of dark glasses. "Writing." "Are you a poet?" "Maybe." I shifted in my seat, acting disinterested, pretending like I didn't recognize him. But there was no mistaking the drawl in his voice nor a shady smile. I knew exactly who I was facing. He was the guy in Don't Look Back. The other one, Bobby Newworth, the peacemaker provocateur, Bob Dylan's alter ego. He was a painter, singer-songwriter, and a risk-taker. He was a trusted confidant to many of the great minds and musicians of his generation, which was just a beat before mine. To hide how impressed I was, I got up, nodded, and headed toward the door without saying goodbye. He called out to me, "Hey, where'd you learn to walk like that?" I turned, "From Don't Look Back." He just laughed and asked me to join him in the El Quixote for a shot of tequila. I wasn't a drinker, but I downed a shot, without the lemon and salt, just to seem cool. He was easy to talk to, and we covered everything from Hank Williams to abstract expressionism. He seemed to take a liking to me. He took the notebook out of my hands and checked it out. I guess he saw potential, for he said, "Did you ever think of writing songs?" I wasn't sure how to answer. "Next time I see you, I want a song out of you," he said as we exited the bar. That was all he had to say. When he left, I pledged to write him a song. Robert came home late, sullen and a little angry that I had drinks with a strange guy. But the next morning he agreed that it was inspiring that someone like Bob Newworth was interested in my work. "Maybe he'll be the one to get you to sing," he said, "but always remember who wanted you to sing first." Robert had always liked my voice. When we lived in Brooklyn, he would ask me to sing him to sleep, and I would sing him the songs of Piaf and child ballads. "I don't want to sing. I just want to write songs for him. I want to be a poet, not a singer." "You can be both," he said. Bobby continued to open up his world to me. Through him, I had met Todd Rundgren, the artists Bryce Marden and Larry Poons, and musicians like Billy Swan, Tom Paxton, Eric Anderson, Roger McGuinn, and Kris Kristofferson. Like a flock of geese, they veered toward the Chelsea Hotel, awaiting the arrival of Janis Joplin. The only credential that gave me entrance to the private world of these people was Bobby's word, and his word was indisputable. He introduced me to Janis as the poet, and from then on, that's what Janis always called me. The intense community of musicians staying at the Chelsea Hotel then would often find their way into Janis's suite with their acoustic guitars. I was privy to the process as they worked on songs for her new album. Janis was the queen of the radiating wheel, sitting in her easy chair with a bottle of Southern Comfort, even in the afternoon. Michael Pollard was usually by her side. They were like adoring twins, both with the same speech patterns, punctuating each sentence with "man." I sat on the floor as Kris Kristofferson sang her "Me and Bobby McGee," Janis joining in the chorus. I was there for these moments, but so young and preoccupied with my own thoughts that I hardly recognized them as moments. When Janis Joplin returned in August for a date in Central Park, she seemed extremely happy. She was looking forward to recording and came into town resplendent in magenta, pink, and purple feather boas. She wore them everywhere. The concert was a great success, and afterward we all went to the Remington, an artist bar near Lower Broadway. The tables were crowded with her entourage, Michael Pollard, Sally Grossman, who was the girl in the red dress on the cover of Bringing It All Back Home, Bryce Marden, Emmett Grogan of the Diggers, and the actress Tuesday Weld. The jukebox was playing Charlie Pride. Janis spent most of the party with a good-looking guy she was attracted to, but just before closing time, he ducked out with one of the prettier hangers-on. Janis was devastated. "This always happens to me, man. Just another night alone," she sobbed on Bobby's shoulder. Bobby asked me to get her to the Chelsea and to keep an eye on her. I took Janis back to her room and sat with her while she bemoaned her fate. Before I left, I told her that I had made a little song for her and sang it to her. She said, "That's me, man. That's my song." As I was leaving, she looked in the mirror adjusting her boas. "How do I look, man?" "Like a pearl," I answered. "A pearl of a girl." Robert took the photograph for my first small collection of poems, a chapbook called Kodak published by Middle Earth Books in Philadelphia. I had in mind that it should resemble the cover of Bob Dylan on Tarantula, a cover of a cover. I bought some film and a white tab collar shirt, which I wore with a black jacket and Wayfarers. Robert didn't want me to wear the dark glasses, but he indulged me anyway and took the picture that would become the cover. Nellie said, "Take the glasses and jacket off." And he took more pictures with just the white shirt. He chose four and laid them in a row. Then he picked up the Polaroid film casing. He slipped one of the pictures in the black metal frame. It wasn't quite the look he wanted, so he spray-painted it white. Robert was able to modify materials and make unexpected use of them. He fished out three or four of them from the trash and spray-painted them. He rifled through the refuse from the Polaroid, the black tab of paper that said, "Don't touch here," and slid it into one of the spent casings. Robert on a roll was like David Hemmings in Blow Up. The obsessive concentration, images tacked on a wall, a cat detective stalking the terrain of his work, the trail of blood, his footprint, his mark. Even Hemmings' words from the film seemed a subtext, Robert's private mantra. "I wish I had tons of money. Then I'd be free." Free to do what? Everything. Robert made every advance toward financial independence. He dragged his portfolio from gallery to gallery, but most often he had the same response. The work was good, but dangerous. Occasionally he would sell a collage or be encouraged by the likes of Leo Castelli. But on the whole, he was in a position similar to that of the young Jean Genet showing his work to Cocteau and Gide. They knew he was great, but they feared the intensity of his gift and also what his subject matter might reveal about themselves. To me, Robert and I were irrevocably entwined, like Paul and Elizabeth, the sister and brother in Cocteau's Les Enfants Terribles. We played similar games, declared the most obscure object treasure, and often puzzled friends and acquaintances by our indefinable devotion. He had been chided for denying his homosexuality. We were accused of not being a real couple. In being open about his homosexuality, he feared our relationship would be destroyed. We needed time to figure out what all of this meant, how we were going to come to terms and redefine what our love was called. I learned from him that often contradiction is the clearest way to truth. Maybe, maybe, maybe.
Part 3 of Just Kids was written and read by Patti Smith. It was abridged by Jeremy Osborne and produced by Rosalind Ward. Tomorrow we hear about a rock music landmark when Patti records her debut album, Horses.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock and Wes Butters with drama up next as Jude and Cousin Sue take drastic action in the next episode of Thomas Hardy's tale of thwarted ambition and marital discord. Then popcorn and fizzy drinks at the ready as Mel's at the cinema on this afternoon's 4 o'clock show for a truly multi-dimensional experience. And Junior Just a Minute will be giving our funny bones an extra tickle in another brand new episode. Loads of fun later from 4. Now, it's the fourth part of the last work by Thomas Hardy, Jude the Obscure. Life just seems to be getting worse and worse for Jude Fawley. After failing to become a scholar, he's now returned to his trade as a stonemason. Meanwhile, his wife Arabella has arrived back from Australia, determined to reclaim him, while the true love of his life, Cousin Sue, is now wed to Phillotson. But despite their both being married, feelings continue to run deep.
Today, Good Friday, I have been to Shaston, a town set on the summit of a steep escarpment which rises out of the Vale of Blackmoor. It's a long climb, once taken by pilgrims in the Middle Ages to reach the shrine of King Edward the Martyr. Believers from all over Europe journeyed here to pay their homage.
The schoolhouse? Tis near the middle. Why, a bit of open space that was the old abbey gardens.
Thank you.
Hey, the schoolmaster bait there, Snow. I seed and go off to a teacher's meeting over to Shottsford, he said.
It's Mrs. Phillotson I'm visiting.
Ah, that one. New wife. Bright young lady, by all accounts.
I am her cousin.
And I thought you might be a school inspector, coming to have a peep while the master's off. You've got a look of learning, see?
Far from it. I'm in fact a stonemason.
Once, when asked the nature of my occupation, I would have answered stonemason, but always stonemason with a prospect of becoming more than that. So how was it, on this holiest of all holy days on the Christian calendar, I told the man, stonemason, stonemason, and nothing more? When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. What it is to become a man, to be torn by adult passions. Even though I strive with all humility to follow the words of St. Paul, it's hard to remain God's servant through and through. Where shall man find redemption? Man who, because of his own nature, strikes his foot, trips and falls from virtue.
It is the place in general that oppresses me, I think. The absurdity of the town, set where it is. Do you know that until they built the waterworks, every drop of water had to be carried up by donkey carts? It's also isolated and insulated. Likewise, the people.